think Tevez going to Juventus, what a coup that was for me. I mean,
that battle, Atletico Madrid can do more damage to Barcelona than the other way around.
Either he's really blind, or he's fixing the match. I can't see it any other way.
I'm trying to get Sir Bob on my side here by saying City will win the Premier League.
It is an upset. You would expect Man United to go and win there.
Over $1 billion was paid in transfer fees between the clubs in Europe.
It's football. It's damn football. Like Ferguson said, football. Bloody marvelous.
Yeah, well, the celebration was, I can't believe I just scored against Mexico.
At one point, Parma, I think it's only like 224 players under contract.
Oh, well, throw me out of here, fellas. You're going to get me arrested on your show.
If you're a serious talent, you're going back and you're playing for Santos. You know, you're going back to play for, like in Argentina, for River Plate or Boca Juniors, or you're going to Europe.
He looked like the Ryan Giggs of old. He was more creative than any player on the pitch. He made Mata look stupid. He made Rooney look silly.
Well, the Premier League is the most exciting league out there. I think it's probably the best marketed league without a question.
When you look at the draw for the Champions League, you kind of say, well, all the pieces kind of fell into place for everybody except City.
I am your host, Joe Mucello.
Sir Bob, Mike Orr. My co-host, Rob Rojas.
My trusted co-host, Ben the Machine.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 192 of Low Limit Football on this 19th of February, 2018, on the All-In Sports Talk Network. I am your host, Joe Mucello, and we are back after a great weekend of football. We will look back on the week that was and discuss when a 2-2 result for a team is great one day and not so great a few days later. We're going to look back on what was dubbed the Conte Derby on this show, and see who's in the driver's seat to land the Italian manager after this week's Champions League results. And while the round of 16 is in full swing in Europe, the round of 16 will kick off this week in the CONCACAF Champions League. We're going to discuss this and much, much more with our very special guest, Mr. Neil Blackman from the YanksAreComing.com. Can't wait to do it, but first and foremost, before we get to that, let me bring in my great co-host, Mr. Roberto Rojas. What's going on, man?
I'm doing well, Joe. It's been a wonderful weekend of football, that's for sure, and a lot of interesting games.
Yeah, and we've had a good week show-wise for us, too. You know, we should probably let everybody know that this week we were able to record three more of our World Cup preview shows. We did the Iran preview with Pasha Hajan from Gold Bazan Podcast. We did Costa Rica with Jorge Camaño from ESPN and Fox Sports. And yesterday we were able to do Spain with David Cartledge from BeIN Sports. Three fantastic, fantastic shows. They're up on the website. If you get a chance, they're also up on our iTunes and Stitcher. So if you want to go check them out, definitely go check them out there, Rob. But we've got 11 shows done so far, right? We're a third of the way through the World Cup field already, huh? Not too bad.
Incredible. No, it's incredible.
Yeah, and this week we've got a great one coming up with Mr. Right now we're scheduled to record with Mr. Luis Miguel Echegaray from SI, and we're gonna be previewing Peru with him, especially with the news, Rob, that the Gaese went down, the goalkeeper for Peru went down with a knee injury. I know you sent that to me the other day. Any word on his injury?
I'm not sure. I just saw it pop up in my Twitter feed. Just give me 1 second, and it's not as bad as one would think.
Oh,
so
good.
That's one thing. It's saying 4 to 6 weeks. Meniscus tear.
Oh, well, you know, good. I'm assuming he's going to have surgery, like, immediately for it and clean that out and get that rolling, and then we'll see him back. That's good because, I mean, he's a huge piece of that Peruvian side, you know, and we'll get to talk to Luis Miguel about it a little bit more this week, but, man, I don't know how they would, you know, how they would replace a guy like Gaese. You know, it would be a big, big loss for them. So,
definitely.
Yeah, so definitely looking forward to it. What did you think of Champions League this week?
Expected, you know, in the way that it's surprising, I would say.
Yeah.
Perhaps many people did not expect one result to go the other way or one result to go that way. Mm-hmm. I will say this, but expected in the way that there's always one kind of shock.
Yeah, and so let me ask you this: what is the shock of choice for you? Because I think there were two of them this week. Let me ask you this: you give me your shock, and then I will tell you the other one that I'm thinking of. So you first, sir.
the big one is obviously Juventus Spurs. I mean, I personally didn't expect Juventus to concede two goals in what is already a talented Spurs side, nevertheless, but knowing the defensive power and all those types of characteristics that Juventus has had recently, you know, you never expect them to concede two at home against Spurs. I mean, I think that, for me, out of all the games that happened last week, I think that was the shock for me.
Yeah, you know, for me, it was PSG. You know, the other shock for me was PSG holding, you know, the majority of the possession of Real Madrid, but giving up those late goals, you know, to Real Madrid, you know, after going ahead 1-0 on the Rabiot goal, really kind of let the fish off the hook. Not so much with losing 2-1, but the third goal. The third goal is killer, and I don't think we expected to see that much out of a Real Madrid side in terms of, you know, the way they've been performing. I mean, even if you look back on the weekend, Rob, they end up beating Betis 5-3, if I remember correctly.
Yes, 5-3.
But they, you know, they jumped out into the one-goal lead, and then were quickly down 2-1 to Betis. And now, granted, Betis doesn't exactly play defense. you know, I think they've conceded 50 goals this season, if my numbers are, you know, if I remember correctly from watching the match on the weekend. You know, so to expect them to give up 5 goals, you know, it stinks, but, you know, Madrid hasn't been performing like that lately. So I think that the 3-1 to PSG, I think, was probably a little more shocking. I think 2-1 would have been something that most would have expected. You know, so that's kind of where we stand. But a great week. We've got some more matches coming up this week. Europa was pretty exciting, too, this week, Rob, with, you know, the Atalanta-Dortmund game that we had recommended everybody watch. 3-2 to Dortmund in that one. And Dortmund jumped out early. Atalanta came back in that one. AC Milan, though, boy, you got to be impressed with them, Rob. They go and win 3-1. I'm sorry, 3-0 against Lagerex in the Champions League or in the Europa League, and then on the weekend put a 2-0 on Sampdoria at the San Siro. So I think out of their last 5 or 6 matches, they're unbeaten.
This is really finding the formula now.
Yeah, it's been something pretty impressive, and slowly but surely, Milan is starting to creep back into that. Yeah, they could win the Europa League section. They could even, because they're, you know, with that win against Sampdoria, stuck their noses back in the European race in Serie A. So, and the team that has to worry is their neighbors or their partners or co-tenants in Inter, who've been slipping.
I've been looking so good as well. I've been cold recently.
Yeah.
And I guess we could just also send a shout out to, I guess, an Inter player himself. He's celebrating his 25th birthday, I mean. That's Mauro Icardi.
That's right, Mauro Icardi's birthday. I'm telling you, Rob, and I said this when we did that show with the happy birthday to Neymar and Cristiano Ronaldo. You've got to be a phenomenal footballer if you're born in February.
But why aren't you?
Well, I am. I'm still playing. What are you talking about? You should have seen the goal I scored on Tuesday.
If that's the case, then you should be starting at Juventus for over Gonzalo Higuain.
I don't think they got many spots on the 46-year-old side.
I could play with the senior team. Okay. And senior, I mean the legend team.
Yeah. Or the running joke would be I could come over to MLS for a contract, right?
There you go. That's even better.
Oh man! All right, let's stop beating them up. Let's because we're going to do MLS preview next week because they're almost back. But you know that's a good segue. Let's get to the trivia question tonight.
Sure.
And the trivia question is actually a CONCACAF Champions League trivia question. With the CONCACAF Champions League kicking off this week, the round of 16, we look back on the 56-year history of the CONCACAF Champions League. Believe it or not, it's that old. And my question to you is this, and the minimum criteria is you had to play in at least 2 finals. Okay? Can you name me the 3 teams that have at least 2 finals appearances and have not lost in the final? There are 3 teams. Bonus points if you can tell me how many wins they have. So there are 3 teams that are unbeaten or undefeated in the Champions League, in the CONCACAF Champions League final, having at least 2 or more appearances. There are 3 teams. You tell me which 3 teams.
Okay.
All right. So we'll get back to you at the end of the show with that one. Let's do opening thoughts, Rob. And actually, I'm going to let you introduce opening thoughts. I think it's a great topic, and it's when you gave it to me as we were talking about what to talk about this weekend. At first, I was like, It's kind of boring, but as I thought about it, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of meat there. So you go for it, man.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the big one here that everyone's talking about is the announcement that Chichi has made, the coach of the Brazilian national team, a couple of days ago. Flat out announced, obviously it wasn't official from the CBF or anything like that, but he just flat out announced in a recent interview on ULL Esporte that he has named 15 players that are certainly going to the FIFA World Cup this summer in Russia. And of those 15 players, the list are as follows. It's a goalkeeper and Alisson, five defenders of Dani Alves, Marquinhos, Thiago Silva, Marcelo, and Miranda, four midfielders, Fernandinho, Paulinho, Casemiro, and Renato Augusto, and the five forwards, Neymar, Gabriel Jesus, Willian, Roberto Firmino, and Felipe Coutinho. So that's your starting 11, I would say, and four other players as well. And you know, I mean, I've never seen a head coach be so certain of these 15 players, but of course with the depth that Brazil has had, and I guess the continuity and obviously the consistency that they've had in the last year, or even since under Chichi, you know, he's been able to stick with these players for quite some time. But, you know, with 15 names left, there's eight that's... You're basically leaving out eight, and of those eight, I would assume it's going to be probably two more goalkeepers, maybe three more defenders. That's four. Three more midfielders and an extra forward, I would say. I mean, you know, and then obviously, you know, we have so much to look out for in the next few months. I mean, the World Cup's not until June, so that leaves four more months left until. And so anything that's happening, I mean, you know, despite this four month gap between now and then, I mean, this sounds fishy to me, don't you think, John?
Yeah, you know, it's strange that he would come out and say something like this. You know, that would give you and not give you a complete side. For me, there's a big danger. And this is where my first thoughts went to, where there's a big danger on alienating some players. So some of the names that are not on this list yet, Alexandro, Douglas Costa, Ederson, right, who's having an incredible season at Manchester City, you start to alienate players. You start to say, what, I'm not good enough to be in that solid 15? Then why do I even want to bother? You know, there's a little more pride, thankfully, in football in the world. I know that in some places you might have a player say, you know what, if I'm not good enough to be your first 15 solid, then I don't want to be on the team because that means I'm not going to play. And you could see where attitudes would start to play a role, and you could fracture a team that way. So I don't like the move that way. But if you think about it, Rob, team's well balanced as it is, right?
I mean, this is Brazil. We're talking about a team that, you know, only lost one game in all of qualifying and never lost a single game in the Chichi yet.
Right, but if you think about it, you know, like you said, you're starting 11. You've obviously got Alisson in goal. You've got across the back, you probably do something like, and I'm just looking through the names quickly, Dani Alves, Marquinhos, Miranda, and then Marcelo. Right.
Yep,
okay.
Right.
In the midfield, you could easily slot in Paulinho, Casemiro, and maybe even go to a guy like Coutinho. Right.
Renato Augusto. You'd go for Renato Augusto. Oh, the front three is would I'll finish it off here. I guess the front three Coutinho. Would be Neymar, Gabriel Jesus, and Coutinho. So yeah.
All right. Oh yeah, and you're not even talking about Firmino there at that point. So nope. I mean, and you've also left Willian off the midfield.
Yep, right? And you're putting Thiago Silva also on the bench.
That's true, but you've got substitutes in each area, right? You don't have a backup keeper yet, but I think the backup keeper is pretty much well set. We talked about that when we did our Brazil preview.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, this is a strong team to begin with, and like we said, the idea of Alexandro, the idea of Douglas Costa, you know, obviously Ederson, I think is a no-brainer. I think he could have gone to 16 and named Ederson in this one. The team is solid, so it's not a poor selection. Let's put it that way. But it is definitely going to be you know, this team. I think you're looking at the 4-3-3, just like you said, right?
Do you feel that maybe if another country was to do this, like say a Germany or an Argentina or I don't know, a France, you know, do you feel like the praise or criticism is still the same?
Yeah, I do. I think a team that has even more right to do this is Germany. if you think about it.
Think about it for a second. If you want to straightforward say what country heading into this World Cup do you feel like is going to be the most hardest and competitive to go on the team? You know, I think the no-brainer could be Brazil.
In terms of the toughest team to get onto?
Exactly.
See, for me, I would think it'd be Germany. And the reason is because they're so deep. You know, it's not like you have two guys competing at that spot. You have four guys. You have five guys. I mean, we saw when they did the Confederations Cup. I forget where it was. It was on ESPN or it was on Bleacher Report. I forget where it was. But they had listed four different teams that you could have made with the players that were not on the squad that went to the Confederations Cup.
Right.
You know, that's amazing. If you think about it, four different teams. You're talking 44 players, Rob. And so we talk about a depth. I mean, but is Brazil deep? Absolutely. 100%, man. Argentina's deep. France is deep. Spain is deep, right?
Yeah.
But four teams deep? It's just, it's mind-boggling that there's that much talent in one country. It's almost criminal. you know? But
when you have four World Cups to your name, I mean, you kind of have to have a reputation.
Yeah, including being the holders.
Exactly.
Top of it all. So, you know, it's just amazing to see the amount of talent, especially even in Brazil, like we said, with the names that are not even quote unquote there yet. You know what I mean?
Right. There's always the one issue. I mean, what if a player gets injured?
Yes, and that's where I go back to the fragmentation of the team. That's where I go back to that. So now let's say Marquinhos is injured, right?
Right.
And let's go to a different spot. Let's go to Marcelo, who actually picked up a knock on the weekend, if I remember correctly, in the Real Madrid game. So now Alexandre would be his natural replacement, right?
Yes.
But Alexandre is a little pissed. You know, why am I not already named Marcelo's replacement? Why am I not even named ahead of Marcelo? Because, you know, there were times in last season when Alexandre was a better back than Marcelo. He's a better left back than Marcelo. So why aren't you naming me? Why are you naming Marcelo right off the bat? So you could fragment a player, or you could fragment a team by doing something like that. And that's the point there, is when, you know, when we're talking about Douglas Costa, not that I wouldn't choose, you know, a guy like, I think his replacement would be Coutinho, right? If I'm thinking,
yes, the understudy of Coutinho. Yep.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah. Naturally, you're going to take Philip Coutinho over Douglas Costa, no doubt about it. I don't think anybody would argue. But maybe Douglas Costa sees himself as having an improved season at Juventus and saying, "Why aren't you taking me? Why aren't you calling me on this team already?"
Right.
You know. So that yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, Coutinho goes down with an injury. He's already coming back from an injury, and he misses the World Cup. And Costa's like, "Oh, what? Now I'm good enough?"
I do have just a little fear is that he's so confident in the starting 11.
Yeah. And you wonder, and here's the thing, you know, you bring up a good point there, because Chiche, he's got enough talent here to play multiple sides, you know what I mean?
Exactly, yes.
He could actually pull these 11 guys off, find a new 11, and still be as competitive.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you wonder if he gets into the Maurizio Sarri syndrome where he says, you know what, these are my 11, that's it. These one or two guys are going to be my subs, and everyone else, well, you got a couple weeks in Russia. Congratulations. Enjoy.
I think the big example would be, you know, a player like Firmino, who's having a wonderful season so far at Liverpool. I mean, you could obviously make the debate that he should be starting over Jesus at striker.
You could, yeah, you could definitely make that debate, and especially with two players in the same league, right? You can look at their performances against similar opponents, because they'll have a huge similarity of opponents there. So yeah, you could compare them. And Firmino, and again, I don't have the stats, and Gabriel Jesus is not on the team, because he's injured. But yeah, so Rob, I'm going to close out because I know that we're looking to have our guest join us right now. He was just checking in. So, hopefully he'll connect to us here quickly. Joining us on Low Limit Football from YanksAreComing.com, Mr. Neil Blackman. Neil, welcome back to the show. How are you tonight?
Hey, guys. I'm great. How are y'all doing?
Good, good. You know, it's perfect timing that you're available now, because Rob and I were just talking about Chiche Brazil naming 15 of his 23-man squad for the World Cup. And in that, I wanted to kind of segue to Champions League a little bit with you, because in that listing, we've got four players from Paris Saint-Germain. We have another two players from Real Madrid. So one of the matches that was like one of the big matches of the week, and we actually called it the Antonio Conte Derby because we figured the loser of this would fire their coach and pick up Conte at the end of the season. And so right now, PSG's in the driver's seat with the 3-1 loss to Real Madrid on last week. So what were your thoughts on that game and their performances, especially with PSG giving up such late goals in that match to really cripple them going back to the Parc des Princes?
Yeah, I mean, so it was kind of a strange game. It was almost like two games in one game. And you know, I think everything that happened after Bale was taken off. And I thought that, it confirmed one thing that we already knew, which was that as much of as trust you speak,
Neil, I'm losing you there a little bit. Are you there?
So,
Neil, can you hear me?
Madrid in the league. Mm-hmm.
Neil, I think I'm losing you there. Let me disconnect you and reconnect you to the call because I'm losing you there. You're breaking up on me. All right, so give me 1 second. I'm gonna add you right back in. And of course, it never fails, Rob. Right with live radio. That we always end up with something like this. So hopefully
that's perfect.
No, I know it. Let's see if we can get Neil back in to join us here. It should be, hopefully it'll clear right up. It's always Skype, never fails, man. But yeah, I liked where he was going with that with PSG, especially the fact that it was kind of a tale of two games, which I think you and I would agree on. And especially the second game would have been Real Madrid's game, and it would have been that late, probably what, like that last 10 minutes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, because up until that point, it was, you know, it was pretty much in PSG's control. But
exactly.
Yeah. Now we're having trouble adding Neil back in here. So let's good old Skype. Of course, we've got everything running well tonight too. We're broadcasting live. Everything was going well with that. So hopefully we'll get him added in here right away and get to it. Again, PSG obviously with the 3-1 losers going back, and I know you wanted to bring up the Spurs Juventus matchup, which we can talk about as well. And maybe once we get Neil to jump back in here, I don't know why we're having trouble adding him, but once we get him back in, you and I kind of talked about this a little bit, Rob, going back last week after the Champions League results. What team is in a tougher spot? You know, obviously, PSG going, you know, down two goals, but going home, and going home, you know, with a road goal, right? Or Juventus, you know, really giving away the opportunity to go ahead and really take a stranglehold on the tie, and now they're in trouble. I mean, they're tied. They really need a 1-0 win to go back when they get back to Wembley, but it can go either way. So, which team is in a worse spot? And I see Neil, you're back. And I'll let Rob answer the question first, but then we'll jump back into PSG. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think when you're looking at a situation where you're going back home and you've already conceded two away goals in the first leg, I mean, I think Juventus is really the team to be, you know, to be, how do I say, like, they should be really scared of getting eliminated in the next game. I think, you know, going into Wembley, you know, going into a team that's hot, like Spurs, you know, Harry Kane's having a wonderful season so far, I would say. And, I mean, you know, I feel about, you know, even one goal or two goals could really damage this entire tie over. I mean, obviously, you know, you never want to concede goals at home. And for Juventus to do that at home is unacceptable. I mean, you know, I'll jump this to you, Joe Law, as a Juventino. I mean, how do you feel about this draw heading back to Wembley?
One, I was incredibly disappointed. And, you know, looking back on the match, you wonder how it happens. But then you look back on it and you're like, you know how it happens. Because Allegri played everybody so deep. I mean, he packed it in, 2-0, 10 minutes up. He packed it. It looked like Allegri took off his mask, and it was actually Mourinho. he had him packed so deep. And when that happened, it just invited a good Tottenham Hotspur side to attack, which they love to do, and you're going to give Harry Kane chances, he's going to kill you. So, you know, it was poor planning on Allegri's part. I don't think he makes the same mistake twice, and I don't think the match plays out the same way going back to Wembley as it did in the first leg here at the Allianz Arena in Turin. Neil, you know, I just want to get you back involved in the conversation. The question I'd asked Rob was, which of the two teams has a better chance of coming back and overturning the first result, Juventus going to Wembley or PSG going home to Real Madrid?
Sorry, guys. I don't know what happened there, but I appreciate you having me on. I think that, you know, as much as I was set to kind of trash PSG a little bit, I still think it's PSG just because we don't know what, and I hate saying that about a team that's the holders of the Champions League, but that they might be the more vulnerable team. But it's just what we've seen all year, right, is that we just don't know what to expect or what we'll get from Real. And we also know that PSG have the attacking types of pieces that you need to kind of accumulate away goals. Whereas I think, I don't know. It just seems to me like if there's a competition that Tottenham has emphasized, it's this competition. And I also think that this addition of Lucas Moura just kind of alters their team so much.
Yeah, that's definitely. I mean, it's really a tough draw heading into now this game in Paris. I mean, I think when a really big team, also like Real Madrid, going into this game against PSG as well, you know, I think this is a situation where, you know, PSG can't concede at all. I mean, when you're looking at such a beautiful attack that Real Madrid has, I mean, it's going to be tough heading into the second leg. I mean, I don't know what kind of changes, you know, Unai Emery has to make. I mean, you know, I think much of the criticism, and I'll jump this back to you, Joe, was given to Neymar for his, showboating final product. I mean, Joe, what do you think about this player heading into this next leg?
You know, it's for me, the showboating, that kind of stuff is always expected, especially. And I don't want to sound like I'm stereotyping him, but of a Brazilian player, a player that plays with that type of passion in their heart. You know, we've seen that from Neymar before. We've seen the excessive celebrations and that sort of thing. And he's a player that can back it up on the pitch. So I'm that kind of stuff doesn't play all too deeply with me. And you also got to remember where Neymar comes from. I mean, Neymar comes from Barcelona, right? I mean, what's their biggest rivalry? Is Real Madrid, and this is something that on his watch, you know, he's had to face Real Madrid multiple times, so I'm sure he felt, you know, celebratory, I would say, you know, in this match, especially when they go up 1-0, like we had said. So, you know, Neil, your thoughts on Neymar? I mean, and also keep in mind, maybe the cockiness comes out and he takes it to them. It's kind of a chip on his shoulder that second leg where he wants to, you know, outperform and really reverse maybe even the PSG ghosts from last year against Barcelona.
Well, I think that's a great point. I actually had a chance to talk to Cleverson not that long ago, and he was, you know, one of the things that he said was that a lot of the Brazilian players have chips on their shoulder right now, that he had spent some time with them in a recent camp before the last round of qualifiers, and that they to put it lightly, that it, you know, the word he used was mission. That there's a mission, and it's not just the embarrassment of what happened on home soil, of course, of Germany that everybody knows about. They have taken the Copa Americas very personally. They took what happened in America very personally, even though, because see, what a lot of people don't understand here is that in America, I think, is that everybody said, oh, well, they didn't send their best team to that American Copa. Well, that's not the attitude in Brazil, isn't so much that as much as it's, well, that's a country that has de-emphasized the Copa America a little bit. They also believe that they're, like, next 23 or as good as everybody else's 23.
Right.
And so there's certainly kind of a mission statement. So you combine that with the fact that Neymar is playing against a club that you know, because he does come from Barca, and then you combine it with just who Neymar is. I mean, he's a guy that plays the game with a lot of joy, and in this era of, you know, social media, kind of creating all these different factions. I mean, I hate to blame social media on it, but, like, I think that has a little bit to do with it. There's a lot of hot takes about Neymar that kind of judge the way that he performs or the way that he plays based on, like, what those social media factions support. You know, when Garinka did that years and years ago, nobody said, you know, it's a similar type of joy and fire. And I think, you know, some people love it, and the people that don't want to cheer for the teams that Neymar plays for, you know, they've villainized him for it.
I would say that the going back to the Copa America, is that the Brazilians wouldn't be nearly as upset, I would say, as the Argentinian fans. You know, having lost back-to-back Copas to Chile, you've got to think that they're a little more pissed about it than the Brazilians, don't you think?
I think that when they reach, and I mean, Roberto, this is like right in his wheelhouse. But I think the thing about Argentina is that they were in those finals, and sure, I'm sure they're very bitter about losing those finals. But there's a distinction maybe between losing finals and performing as terribly as Brazil have at the last two Copa Americas. To where, like, national newspapers' headlines are like, this is embarrassing, like, you're a national embarrassment. So that's part of why they've, you know, Cleverson used the word mission with me, was, you know, they steamrolled through what I think is the toughest region in the world. And you know, they're on a mission, and I think that the 15-player announcement was part and parcel of that. Like, look, guys, you guys concentrate on everything you have going ahead of you because you're going to the World Cup. And we'll find the other eight, but you're the core that we think can bring that trophy back to our country. Where it belongs.
That's interesting. I actually didn't look at it that way so much as I looked at it in the way where it could fragment a team and say, you know, looking at the players that aren't named yet, looking at them and saying, hey, you know, why didn't you pick me already? Why am I not on this team already? You know, that's my fear of doing something like that. I would almost have rather seen him unload, you know, announce 23 or announce nothing. You know, that's why it was kind of unusual for me.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. I mean, it's hard to argue with that. I mean, I could definitely see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting either way, if you think about it. You know, like you said, your way also makes a ton of sense. You know, you 15 guys, you're here. So don't worry about what we're going to do here or leading up into training camp or friendlies or anything like that. Go do your club thing. Don't worry about us. And then when you're done with your club thing, then come over here, pick up your uniform, and we'll see you on the pitch. So it makes sense in that perspective, too. By talking it out that way, you almost make it a non-story because it could be really controversial or really assuring. It's, you know, and I guess there's some happy medium there somewhere. So let's move on. Let's stick with Champions League real quick, though, and talk about the big one, I would say, this week. We've got some nice matchups, but I think the best one or the biggest one or the most anticipated one is tomorrow's matchup between Chelsea and Barcelona. You know, right now you look at Chelsea, I mean, everyone wants Conte's head on a platter for some reason. All the guy has done so far in a year and change is win the EPL title, right? I mean, and he's gotten them to the knockout stages of the Champions League. So, I mean, I'm sorry, he's been successful, although everyone wants to crucify him. And I think it's unfortunate that he draws Barcelona, I think arguably right now the best team in the world, or the best world. You know, everyone would want to put City in there. I know everyone wants to talk City, Wigan earlier today, whatever. For me, it's Barca really at this point. I thought that before the City result today. I've thought for a while now that Barca is the best team in the world, and that team got rid of Neymar. You know, the Paulinho addition has been an absolute godsend for them. And then they go and add Coutinho in, which will make him just better. But I don't believe Coutinho's available for this because I think he's cup tied to Liverpool. So, right. So, you know, your thoughts on this matchup coming up, because, you know, this is still the EPL champions. They're still the title holders until probably about 6 weeks from now when City, you know, earns the trophy.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is why I'm interested on Roberto's takes on Barca, because like Man City, Barca can tell you about losing a cup tie, right? I mean, that's the only loss they have in months is Espanyol. So strange things happen in cup competitions. For me, this is just about the fact that Barca defend better than they have in 5 years, in my opinion. They only conceded, I think, 12 goals.
Do you think that's up to Samuel Umtiti, the addition of Umtiti instead of I can't even think of the who they had last year, Rob, central defender.
I think that has a ton to do with it. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they defend better and then Chelsea, it's kind of Hazard or bust because you have Batshuayi now playing pretty well at Dortmund. I'm sure a lot of Chelsea fans are aggrieved over that. Mm-hmm. And so you're in this situation where even if they defend well, and historically, what have Barca struggled with in this competition, right? They've struggled against teams that can kind of pack things in mm-hmm. and stay compact centrally, which Chelsea's really good at doing. But to beat Barca in this competition over two legs, you better be able to score goals. So the question I would pose to Roberto, I guess,
yep.
is who could do that? I mean, because Barca's going to neutralize Hazard, one would think, right? So that's the question for me is, like, when I think of how Chelsea wins this over two legs, I just can't think of where their production comes from.
Are you talking about, like, in terms of Chelsea, like, where are they going to get their goals from?
Yeah, where do the goals come from?
Hazard. Absolutely. Right, I think he's the only one. Unfortunately, because we didn't really see much of Alvaro Morata, I think he's been having a disappointing season. I think that's the opinion that many people are starting to bring, for having his, brewing chances in big games of simple chances as well, unless he steps up and really performs well. I mean, the only player that's only going to be good enough to really produce those talents, either providing assists or scoring goals, I mean, it's Hazard. I mean, simply put, I mean, I think there's no other player on that team that is able to supply that. Maybe Giroud, maybe him. I mean, he did score a couple of days ago, but I'm still confident that Hazard is the one that really is going to do all the heavy lifting for Chelsea tomorrow.
Right, and it has to be him because, like I said, Batshuayi is in Dortmund. We haven't really seen it from Giroud, and we know that you have this resurgent Suarez to compliment, a guy that I was tweeting earlier, largely just to get my mentions going, that I think I've now kind of moved into the greatest player of all time category as opposed to the one of the five. I have decided that I think he's the best ever.
When did you find that out, Neil? I'm just curious.
When did I decide he was the best player ever?
Yes.
You know, it's really been this year, just watching that team this year and like thinking, oh, how foolish were you, Neil, to like think that the last couple years where Madrid was winning, it was because Messi had slipped a little bit. And then, of course, there's that image of the frustrated Messi at the World Cup in 2014, which I think stuck with some people in that debate for a while. And then, you're like, well, is it ever going to get better for Argentina? But that's a different discussion. Like, if he could not win with Mascherano, then where do they go moving forward? But that's a discussion we have months to have.
No, absolutely. And I'll just jump in real quick. I mean, I'll go back to you, to this, Joe. I mean, this team could really fight for it all. I mean, they could really go for the treble, can't they, Joe?
Well, Barca, of course. I mean, yes. It's crazy to not think that. I mean, it was funny. You and I were talking about this yesterday about Real Madrid, with the win. They're kind of inching back into this race. And I'm like, listen, Barca doesn't have to worry about Real Madrid. They have to worry about the other Madrid team because they're quote-unquote only 9 points ahead of Atleti. which is really dumb to say because I don't see Barca losing more than two games this season if they do at all. I mean, we're still sitting here. It's February, and they haven't lost in league. So think about that. I mean, that's – so to expect them to even ask them to lose two games – means that even if Atleti runs the table, they're still not there. They're still short. So yeah, I mean, that one's wrapped up. You've got to think that the Copa del Rey is going to be at least something serious. And the Copa del Rey is really where that Coutinho move makes sense. And we've talked about that before, Rob. Coutinho's going to get heavy Copa del Rey minutes. No doubt about it, right?
That's a great point.
So that's the only title or trophy that he can affect. Because I think the La Liga thing is not done, but man, the fat lady certainly is. That's almost done. But this Champions League, this one is going to be the one where I think they're going to put all the Barca eggs in that basket. And if they do that, then as Chelsea, you've got to worry. I mean, you've really got to worry.
Well, as always, you have to remember the last time these two teams faced, you know, that was one of the best Barcelona sides of all time. And then Chelsea ended up winning, I believe it was 3-2 on aggregate. So these two have history together, and Messi's never scored against Chelsea as well. So and his four times, so that's going to be really interesting to see what he can do there.
You know, and if you think about it from that standpoint, you know, the defense is not bad. You know, and Courtois on goal really makes them that much stronger. But a guy, what makes them strongest in defense, Rob and Neil, for me, is Conte. Because Conte, he can coach a defense. He can do this before. If he needs to win one game, he can do that. You know, he can really do that. I think he got on 2016 Euros.
I mean, I think it was our friend Grant Wall that said, "Has a defensive? Have you ever seen a defensive midfielder win the Premier League?" You know, like, I mean, this is a dominant player. I still think they'll need to score goals.
Yeah, they're gonna need to find goals. And Rob, as much as they go Hazard or bust, they really need to go find somebody else to score.
They need to do it here in this first leg at home, because two goals for this Barca side, you know, and take that all the way back to Camp Nou in the second leg. You know, you have to say this tie's over.
I would say if Barca score two goals in this game tomorrow at Stamford Bridge, yeah, the party's over.
So let me ask you guys. I mean, you know, what are, because to me, the most interesting of the second week ties is Sevilla and Manchester United.
I think that's a tricky one, to be honest.
It's a really tricky one.
That one is a really tricky one, because Sevilla hasn't really performed the way they have even last year in league. So we haven't seen quite the good Sevilla team that we saw before, but they're still so dangerous. And United can be a little Jekyll and Hyde from time to time. So you know, I think this one is a difficult one to call, Rob. How about you?
Yeah, definitely. I think what Vincenzo Montella needs to do is really find that cohesive team and get the best out of players like Steven Nzonzi, you know, get the best out of players like, what's it, Wissam Ben Yedder, Banega, Correa, those guys. And, you know, and to be honest, you know, there could be the possibility of a shock. I mean, you know, we've seen the consistency Sevilla has had for quite some time, be it under Unai Emery or even Jorge Sampaoli last season. You know, they're really good. They are a really good team that could really surprise anyone in this Champions League.
And they're the kind of team that seems to play up to who they're playing, too. Right? Like,
yes.
Depending, they play to their competition level. And so, like, there's something to be said for they'll just see Manchester United on the kit name and on the scoreboard and say, oh, we better be cohesive and great today. And so you kind of countenance that with this weird drama between Pogba and Mourinho and whatever's going on at Old Trafford. And it just seems like such a tricky set of fixtures for the Premier League clubs. After such a dominant first week, like we had all these laurels about, oh, they scored 12 goals in three games, and look at them go. And now we could be talking about like Chelsea being basically hopeless, and you know, Manchester United being in trouble.
Yeah, you know, and for me, for United, I always find the back line to be lacking. I think David De Gea, you know, and his abilities covers up a lot of mistakes that Sevilla makes. Yeah,
yes.
That he's such a difference maker. But you know, looking at what Sevilla is going to bring on the other side of the ball, and Luis Muriel, Franco Vasquez, Nolito's coming back over there from Manchester City, Steven Zanzi, who was like the target of like a million clubs going into the summer transfer window last year. This is a team I think that attacking wise can really cause problems, and De Gea is going to have a very good game, if not the game of his career. I don't think it's that drastic, but I think he's going to have an incredible game. And also keep in mind, I think United really had the luck of the draw in the group stages. I don't feel like they were really challenged in the group stages of this Champions League, so I think there's a little deception there in terms of how good this team actually is.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's certainly one of the toughest ones to call. You look at the other ones, you know, the Bayern Munich Besiktas one, I don't see Bayern dropping anything there. I really think that Bayern is going to totally take control of that tie and really score two or three goals on that first leg. Besiktas, I don't think sees the back of the net. The one I think that is tough for me to call is as well as the United match is the other Wednesday match, the Shakhtar Roma match, because Shakhtar, you know, can be deceptive at home. Very difficult place to go play, and Roma hasn't been exactly top-notch in league as of late. So, you know, I think there could be some serious issues in that matchup for Roma. And for me, as an Italian Serie A fan, you know, a Roma loss would really just cap the disappointment on this particular round of Europa and Champions League matches, because the only shining light, guys, in for Italians right now is Milan. That's insanity. 3 weeks ago, you'd have said, yeah, there's no way Milan's getting out of the damn Europa League, and here they are. They're just rolling teams 3-0 week in and week out. And
well, you still could have, I mean, you could have Dortmund on the road. I mean, you can't take, but yes, no, I mean, Dortmund could be in trouble too. So you could be in a situation where, for one, it's just the way that a tie ended where you're sour on them.
Yeah. I mean, and like I said, everybody needs a little Papu Gomez. And Atalanta has it in spades, so we'll see. But that Dortmund team also, you know, on the weekend playing Mönchengladbach, I thought performed much better than they had in weeks past. And
who'd far better.
And who'd have thought Marco Reus, you know, scores the goal? And a goal, just what an incredible goal that he scored. But Marco Reus, the difference, I mean, you never thought you'd say that in a million years, because he's injured when he walks in the locker room.
It's a World Cup year. All the Germans are healthy.
Everyone's fit and healthy. It's a miracle.
Yeah, but they'll just replace it with the other three Germans that they have in this position.
I know. So, you know, before I segue, because obviously things are going real well in the German Federation, not so well in the U.S. Federation. But before I segue there, this is one thing that Rob and I were talking about in opening thoughts. We were talking about the deepest teams. And Rob, you kind of hinted that you thought maybe Brazil was the deepest.
Or Germany as well, but I think that big competition as to what team is the hardest to get on has to be one of those two.
Right.
So Neil, we wanted to get you guys on the TYSC pod and kind of pick your brains.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And then we can talk to Joe about Italy, and then we can talk. we can talk to Joe about some of the teams that he saw in Italy's abysmal trip to nowhere, and then we can discuss with Roberto some of the challenging choices that Brazil has to make,
right,
you know, with that lineup.
As I'm drowning in my tears. Thanks, Neil.
Well, I mean, like, what do you do with Willian? And I think some of these sorts of questions are those good problems to have,
yeah,
but still really intriguing ones.
All right, let's move on to big problems instead of good problems. Let's go to big problems because I know you're definitely going to have an opinion on this one, and that's obviously. I guess let's start with the election, right? Before we get to the men's national team and head coach and
sure.
All that stuff, let's start with the election. Carlos Cordero obviously winning. We had 8 candidates. 6 of them were the quote unquote change candidates. 2 were the establishment candidates, and the establishment candidate won. I was surprised after the first round of voting, Kathy Carter was so high up on the food chain. You know, but for me, I'm struggling with the soccer federation and the rules, because before a ballot was even cast, before they even showed up in Florida for this convention and this vote, one of those establishment candidates had 20% of the vote locked. Locked,
right.
And that's insanity. When you only need 50 plus one, you're 20% of the way there. That's crazy. But that's the way the federation is built right now. I mean, how do we change that? You know, how do we change that?
Well, so I mean, that's a great question. I think the shortest, most simple answer is you change it a lot of the same ways that you change local politics. You have to win local federation, state association type elections to change who your voting bloc is comprised of, and then if you win those, then you can press larger reforms to the board about the voting system and structure. So I think that's part of it. And you guys, I mean, follow me. You know that I'm not like aggressively. I try to just listen to the arguments without taking super definitive, strong positions on things like pro-rail or whatever. Like, I think we'd be better in an open system, but I'm not, like, aggressive about it. I think that the closed system and the nature of that relationship between MLS and SUM creates, Soccer United Marketing creates some of these structural blocks where you can't really say that the votes aren't already cast. Like you said, like those votes were going to go to Kathy Carter. That's the end of the discussion. So you're in this situation where you're playing for 80% of the votes. We should be playing for a lot more than that in an open election. But we can't do that with changing the association well before you get to Orlando. And then once you change local elections, you can implement change in a broader sense by changing rules or composition of the board or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just jump in real quick and obviously talk about the national team a bit more. Obviously, you know, I think for all of us, I think this is going to be a big year of change. You know, we're going to have to see what the national team is able to do. And they do have a few friendlies for 2018. Obviously, it's not a World Cup year, but they do have three friendlies to play. In 2018, one in March and two in June. And that's Paraguay in Cary, California, North Carolina, the Republic of Ireland on June 2nd, and then France in Lyon. Real quick, I mean, is this a good test for this United States side?
I love the two European games. That doesn't mean that I don't respect Paraguay as an opponent. I do.
Yep.
It's just that my issue with that is we saw this story last week that I thought was kind of interesting because it was Jeff Carlisle, who is, you know, one of the two or three most informed people and that reports on our sport in our country. And he says that the U.S. would like, to bring a heavy group of their European players to America for the game against Paraguay. But what incentive does a Pulisic have to come and play in that game? What incentive does an ever-injured John Brooks have to come in that game, or Weston McKennie? Not a very good one. Not a very big one. So what I would think is that you'll see a more MLS-heavy contingent play Paraguay, and then maybe the only times you'll see Pulisic in particular and Brooks in a U.S. shirt, or maybe even McKennie in a U.S. shirt this year, will be in the two sort of send-off games for those, or the send-off game for France, in Europe. Because they're just not going to come over for a two-day camp to play Paraguay. It doesn't make sense.
No, of course, I agree. And I think, unfortunately, I think in vice versa, you would see Paraguay go for their strongest team. I think they'll have the right to do it, because, you know, I think they play the United States and they play Japan, and Japan send-off friendly, so they have all the right to really send their strongest players. And
of course
the United States is a good match. I mean, I'll jump this over to you, Joe. What do you think about these three friendlies that the United States have to have this year?
You know, I'm with Neil on this, where what incentive do we have, or does Christian Pulisic have? Think about it. I mean, he's going to be on the team. You know, when we get back to this in 2022, hopefully, he's going to be there, barring some crazy injury, right? Weston McKennie, he's going to be there, no doubt about it. Carter Vickers, going to be there. John Brooks, going to be there. These guys are all going to be there. So there's no incentive for them to come over at the end of a long European season where they're, you know, for the most part, they're in European competitions on top of their own domestic leagues and domestic cups, to come over and play 2-3 matches to send off another team. It's just, if I'm Christian Pulisic, I'm not interested at all.
Man, it's a nice pitch, Joe. You know, I mean, North Carolina Courage play there, and the NASL was there for a while. They played the NCAA championships there, so it's not like one of these situations where they're going to have to roll over grass on turf or anything like that, but it's still, I mean, you're still talking about a cross-ocean flight to play, to have a two-day camp and play friendly against a South American side that's reputable for being physical and you know, playing crunching and hard-fought soccer matches. Like, why would they do that, like you said, at the end of a long European season? So, the France is good, though. The France match is, that's, you know, the only thing that bothers me about it is I didn't like the move, and I've written this, I've said it on shows, I'll say it to you guys. I thought it was a mistake to hire a member of the field staff as the interim manager, and I don't think that they will have a manager until after the World Cup. So I think it's an error to have a staff that already failed evaluating these players.
Right.
I understand why they did it, Most of it was economical. But, you know, I don't know. I just don't think it's that particularly productive when there were other people within the Federation who could have had the job that are going to have an active role in the Federation in the future.
For me, I wasn't as harsh on the Sarakan move, just because the one thing I didn't want is I didn't want the outgoing regime to appoint the coach, because that really points the direction of the players, the style, you know, all of that stuff, you know, technical director kind of stuff. So I wasn't as harsh on that. I mean, we all know Sarakin's there. He's not staying. And there's going to be plenty of good coaches at the end of the World Cup that are going to be out there, because what happens naturally at the end? You've got 31 guys that might be searching for a job and one guy that's going to decide if he's going to stay. I mean, that's the reality of it, you know.
So, that's a good point.
So there's going to be good coaches out there. I don't think we need to worry so much about Sarakin so much. And that's why I don't put too much into these friendlies coming up, and especially if I'm Christian Pulisic or John Brooks, because there's nothing there for me. Let's put it this way. Let's say, you know, we've got a new U.S. president. We have a new direction of U.S. soccer. We're going to go more to a Latin American-based style and coaching, and we're going to pay more attention to those players, i.e. Jonathan Gonzalez. You know, we're going to do that kind of stuff now, okay? We're going to start to incorporate that into our persona. Then, if I'm John Brooks or Christian Pulisic, and that ideology has been... We've focused on that ideology, and we are moving in that direction, and we've got a head coach that is moving in that direction. Then you know what? Yeah, maybe I will come back, because even though it is 9 hours one way on a flight, I get to work with that coach. I get to see where his head is at. You know what I mean? And see where the focus is. So from that standpoint, you know, looking at these friendlies, yeah, I would move in that direction if those things were in place. They're not. And they're not going to be until after the World Cup. So yeah, if I'm Christian Pulisic, I don't care. You know, the U.S. is not going to play a meaningful match. I think until what, September of 2019?
Yeah, they'll play 2019. So the Gold Cup.
Right. So yeah. So the summer of 19. So will
yeah,
first
June 2019.
And by then, I think guys like Pulisic and Brooks will pay more attention to the friendlies on the backside of the coach hiring, you know, because then the focus will be there, and then we can look at the 2019 Gold Cup and then decide what our identity is. You know, that's my thing. You know, one thing I want to ask you, just focusing on that standpoint, Rob and I have talked about this on the show a couple of times. Who should be the next head coach of the U.S. men's national team? And I guess it really depends on what kind of focus you want. I mean, you know, are we bringing in Yupankis? You know, a coach like that. Are we bringing in Antonio Conte? Do we want to play that style of football? I still feel that we are letting the Latin American part of us go. I think Klinsmann, for all the good that he did do with the Soccer Federation, and he did do some good. Let's not deny that. But I think he ignored that part of our identity as a nation, and I think it cost us in the end to an extent. So I want to ask you, who do you think that next coach should be as soon as the cops go by?
Well, I saw him at the siren. I don't know what's going on outside.
No, but who do you think should be that next head coach?
So the three names that I actually kind of anticipated this might be a question, and I wrote down three names. My first call would be to Carlo Ancelotti. I don't know if he'll say yes. I know that people are going to grimace. I think that brand of football is probably one that suits what our personnel is best at this point in time. I do not know if at his age he would be interested in that length of a rebuild with the next possible World Cup being 2020, and only sort of a vague promise of a Copa America in between. I think, like Grant Wall, that Juan Carlos Soler will be somebody that they speak to. I think he gets a bad rep, like every manager ever in the Mexican press. Yeah. I think that in the conversations I had when I was in Mexico working on finishing my book on CONCACAF, the Mexican players I spoke to adore him. They credit him with the strength of the cycle. And I think that his players play really hard for him. I don't know what a great tactical manager he is. I know in MLS the results were mixed. Mm-hmm. But I like that he has a foot in three continents, right? I like that he has connections to South America, North America, understands the professional league MLS, and has his connections to Europe as well. So I think that's probably important. And then I think Tab Ramos will get a long look.
Okay.
And I think he has earned a long look. Based on the performances of his youth sides, it does concern me that that's all he's managed. And it does concern me that he's been, in particular, very defensive of the Arena regime, while being more eager to kind of cast aside and asunder the work of the Klinsmann regime. But, you know, I do think that Tab would probably bring people like Hugo Perez, if given a full role, back into the fold. And I think that you touched on such an important aspect and piece of the challenge ahead of Cordero is, you know, in addition to hiring a new manager, agenda 1B should be increasing Latin American participation in the sport. Mm-hmm. And however that impacts the national team down the road is a separate question, but we need to make it a priority to have inclusion in underserved communities with people of color. And if we don't think that the future of this game isn't brown faces in this country, then we're in for more failures like 2018. That's just my take.
Absolutely. You know, I even to further that point a little bit, it's not so much that we're talking about African American or Latino, because I don't want to label, but we need the best athletes. And whether those athletes are black, brown, you know, green, aliens, whatever. We've got to make it accessible to all walks of life. It can't be a rich kid sport, because as you start to do that and you start to escalate the monetary part of the game, then you start to eliminate kids that you can look at, and those kids might be the best athletes, and you're going to miss them. So that's a Cordero issue, though. I think that's got to be one of the main things on his plate in the first 100 days. It has to be. It is just how do you get all the kids? Not just the rich kids, not just the tall kids, not just the strong kids or the fast kids. How do you get all the kids? Because that's your future right there. And I know sometimes it sounds stupid, but you know, when you're passionate about soccer, you want the best. You want your team to be the best, whether it's the national team or your club team. And he's got to find a way to dig these kids up, to recognize them, and then to develop them, regardless of cost. That should be the challenge of the U.S. Soccer Federation for me. I'm going to throw two names out at you. And Rob, I'll throw these names out at you, too. One I've thrown out a million times, and Rob, I know your opinion on this name, and that is Tata Martino. And he kind of holds the Osorio characteristics. He's MLS. He knows North America. He's coached in South America. He's coached in Europe. He has ties to all three continents, right? He has ties to the main league here. He knows how U.S. soccer operates. He's coached the national team. You know, and I think he's a guy that might be a great choice. He's done absolutely incredible stuff at Atlanta United. The other name doesn't have all the ties, at least I don't think he does, that not off the top of my head. And Rob, I want you to respond to this one first, because I don't know that we've talked about this one yet. But another former Mexican coach in Miguel Herrera. You know, I know people, you know, they sour on that, but maybe that's the kick in the pants that this federation and this country needs.
Go ahead, finish.
No, please, jump in.
No, if people are idolizing Marcelo Bielsa and want him on the national team, I mean, I don't know why you can't get someone like I mean, they're two great names. I think Tata Martino is obviously a name that I think any team would like to have, especially in the United States. The one problem, of course, and unfortunately, this shouldn't be a dig to U.S. soccer or even just, you know, managers being here as well. I mean, it's always going to be a language barrier. I mean, Tata Martino just came to the United States just last year. You know, I mean, as much as, you know, we need to respect and hopefully for him, I mean, obviously I think I see him coming back to Paraguay. I think that's always been his intention, to finish his career. He's has everything over there. He's basically treated like his second country, I would say, over Argentina. I feel that is probably the one thing that's going to be hanging out of the balance. But personally, I would love to see Mia Herrera. I think he would be a wonderful name that could really, you know, give the U.S. soccer really a good kick in their butt, I would say, and really be self-aware about all the problems that are happening there.
Yeah. So with Herrera in particular, I think that there's a difference between what his interest level would be and what Martinez would be. Okay. And I mean, I say this frankly as somebody that's relatively well connected to Atlanta United, and you know, I don't have any direct conversation with Tata. I'm not going to speculate on what Tata Martino would say if the U.S. directly offered him the job, but I think it would be a harder sell. You'd need to pull in Carlos Bocanegra and kind of have him redirect those conversations and kind of gauge Tata's interest in that. Because what we have to remember is that it's an extensive real soccer, as you pointed out, so June of 2019, the Gold Cup. So you're really looking at 2020 when you're first getting ready to play serious games. I'd be interested in the job. I don't know if he wants it as bad as Osorio, which, you know, Osorio has made no secret that that's the job he wants. That he'd love to be the manager of the U.S. men's national team, that he thinks that he has all these ideas that he thinks would work in America, and he feels like the press would be more receptive to him than they are in Mexico, but that's, you know, I think that's any country in the world. and I agree with Rob that Tata, I think, you know, if his heart is set on a national team again, there's only one national team it's set on. So that's kind of my response to that question, is that I think Tata in a vacuum, sure, but I don't think that he would actually be interested in taking the job.
So let me ask you this to close out the interview. And again, you've given us a ton of time tonight, so thank you very, very much.
Of course.
And never mind your opinion or who you think would be, you know, I guess, you know, the names that you've given us. Who do you, Neil Blackman, want to see as the next national team head coach?
Well, like I said, my first call would be to Ancelotti, because I think that with the personnel that the Americans have at present, that's probably the best fit. And because you're still building this team, ideally we would have been building it around kind of an aging out Michael Bradley surrounded by Weston McKennie and Jonathan Gonzalez. Well, we're not. So it's sort of, what can we build with Weston McKennie, John Brooks, and Christian Pulisic? And Bobby Wood, who I think is actually a really good player.
I think
Ancelotti is a guy that could maximize sort of that core four. Mm-hmm. With his style. And get to the Americans where they're not leaking goals, which, if you look at this hex, and I don't want to relitigate the whole tournament, but the biggest problem, other than benching Jeff Cameron for the last two matches, was that they just
hemorrhaged.
All right. The venue was the problem, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the venue is not why Marco Arena decided that he was only going to score in the hex in that game.
Yeah, right. All right, so I'm sorry. Let me close with this then. Look into your crystal ball. Who will be the next coach of the U.S. men's national team?
I'm going to stick with our friend Grant Wall's prediction of Osorio. I think that he'll be the guy. I think Mexico gets to the quarters, and then they're fired because they don't play stylish enough in the quarterfinals. Because you know how the FMF works.
Exactly.
So coming off that masterful triumph, he takes the reins in the United States.
That would not be a bad choice, man. Thank you again for joining us. Where can they catch the pod?
So you can catch the pod on iTunes or Blog Talk, Yanks Are Coming Soccer Show. And then I'll have an election. Whoa!
Yeah.
I'll have a piece up tomorrow on kind of the post-election challenges for Cordero and how I would go about addressing them sequencing-wise, which touches on some of the things we talked about tonight. But I appreciate you guys having me on.
No, we appreciate you coming on, man, and definitely we'll talk soon.
All right.
Have a good night. Neil Blackman from the Yanks took some time, Rob.
Yeah, it's been years.
Yeah.
It's been years.
Yeah, so I'm really glad that we connected and got to have him on tonight, because he's a fantastic interview, and he's really knowledgeable about everything across football. So let's recap, Rob, real quick. You know, the scores. I'm going to recap the scores of the matches Actually, I don't even have them all up here yet. Give me 1 second. The scores of the matches from Champions League from this past week, we'll give you the matches that we detailed with our interview with Neil. Give you some matches to look at also on the weekend for our leagues. And then we'll go from there. Sound good?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So, to recap last week's results, we look at the Tuesday matchups. A lead and a quote-unquote missed penalty by Gonzalo Higuain to allow Tottenham back in and draw level 2-2. Before I move on, Rob, you placed blame on Higuain for losing that match or joining that match at all?
No. After a while, no. Right. I mean, I'd probably place the blame more on Conte, don't you think, Joe?
Right,
not Conte, no, Allegri. Allegri. Sorry.
Amen. Yes. 100%. Guy scored 2 goals. You've got such a record at home. You've got to put your team in a position to at least win that match. Even if you give up one, you've got to put your team in a position to win that match. And I don't think Allegri did that. So yeah, I would put most, if not all, of that blame on Allegri himself. Wednesday matchups. Liverpool 5-0 over Porto. 5 Rob goals, Rob. I mean, do you think we see Jurgen Klopp possibly start at defensive mid for the second match?
He can start whatever he wants. I still don't think Porto's going to come back and score 6.
if I'm him, I'm probably starting the janitor, the ticket guy at the booth. You know, yep. Maybe a couple of stewards, and Firmino. You know, just in case.
The lunch lady.
Exactly. 5 road goals. 5-0. That tie is done.
And you're at home as well. You know, you should let the fans come in for free.
Yeah, you should. Yeah, exactly. So, and another one, the big one, like we said, the Conte Derby, which is Real Madrid 3, PSG 1. But I think between the Juve-Tottenham match and the Madrid-PSG match, I think we both feel that PSG is something in a better position to advance. I wouldn't put advancement off on either of those two teams, Juve or PSG. You could easily see Juve, who I think... have the most 1-0 wins in Serie A this season. You could easily see them winning at Wembley 1-0 and moving on. I mean, you know, you definitely don't put it past them. Just as much as you could see PSG scoring 3 or 4 goals against Real Madrid and moving on in that one. So I think, although those ties look a little bleak, I don't think they're over by any stretch of the imagination.
No, absolutely not.
So let's move ahead, obviously, we previewed these with Neil as well this week. We're going to look at the Tuesday matchups. The first one, Bayern Munich-Besiktas. This is at the Allianz in Munich, Tuesday, 2:45 p.m. You know, I don't think there are any surprises here. I think Bayern is going to be in full control of this one, don't you, Rob?
Yes, I do.
And I think right now with Munich, with their lead in the Bundesliga, I think all their eggs are in this basket. And I don't think we see a repeat from 2 years ago where they totally fell on their faces because they kind of mailed it in. The other Tuesday matchup, Chelsea-Barca. This is probably the worst case scenario for Antonio Conte, but it is probably he's probably one of the few coaches I think left in this competition who is capable of organizing a side to beat Barca. Don't you think?
There's no surprise in this one. I think this is the big one.
Yeah,
I think so as well. But again, I mean, it would have to take a huge mountain to climb to beat this Barcelona side.
Definitely, no doubt about it. On the Wednesday matchups, Shakhtar AS Roma. You know, this one's gonna be. I think it's gonna be too close to call. Wouldn't shock me if we saw maybe a 1-1 draw in this, or even a 1-0 loss for Roma to Shakhtar Donetsk, coming back to Roma for the second leg. The second one, Manchester United Sevilla. Again, this one is so hard to call at Old Trafford. On Wednesday at 2:45, Rob, it's you could see Sevilla putting 3 goals in this one, and you could see a 0-0 draw. You know, you could see both ways. I don't know which one that one's going to go.
Yeah, totally.
So let's also go back over to the Europa League quickly. We saw Dortmund Atalanta finish 3-2 Dortmund. Napoli Leipzig. Rob, this one makes me sick to my stomach.
Like Nima said last week, I mean, he wasn't surprised because, you know, he said he wouldn't be surprised if that were going to lose because they're mainly going to miss the Scudetto.
Yeah. I mean, when your entire right side is Tonelli, Maggio, Rogue, and Unas, that's not the same team that you would normally get out there with Insigne and a couple of the other players. So it's just... it's disappointing for me, Rob, because I would have hoped that they would have put more focus on this, and you know, and I guess maybe the Italian side just feel that now that they get those automatic spots, it's not as big of a deal. You know what I mean?
Rightly so.
Yeah. So, but matches to watch this week in the Europa League. The 1 o'clock matchup is Lazio Steaua Bucharest. This one is going to be in Rome, but Steaua Bucharest 1-0 on aggregate on this one, Rob. Another disappointing performance from Lazio here, and they're going to have to come home and score a couple of goals. They're down 1-0 in the first leg, in a tie that I would think that they should be, 2-0 up with coming home with two road goals. Really, just need a 1-0 victory. Now, I don't think they're going to shut out Dortmund 1-0, but Gasperini's been, he's done a masterful job for a little over a year and a half now. So anything is possible, I think, in this one. And I think it's going to be one of the more entertaining ties to watch midweek. I think that Chelsea-Barca is probably the best one. But I wouldn't sleep on this Atalanta-Dortmund.
Me neither. Being such a close tie, I mean, this could definitely be the most interesting matchup out of all of them in this round of 32.
Definitely, no doubt about it. So, and then, Rob, we got some league matches on the weekend, too. We don't want to neglect the leagues, right?
Absolutely, and I think the first thing that we should mention is in the week ahead is obviously it's going to be the first game is in La Liga. It's going to be Sevilla Atletico Madrid Sunday at 2:45 p.m. I mean, Joe, you obviously said that it isn't the Real side that's fighting for this; it's the Atletico side that's fighting that Barcelona team in first place. Sevilla are in fifth with 39 points, and rightly so. I mean, depending on the Real Madrid slip-up, which we almost saw over the weekend, Sevilla could really put themselves in pole position to get into a Champions League spot. I think they're always going to be focused on the Champions League regardless, but, I think they want to have that consistency yet again, and who knows, let's see if Valencia's is getting losing a bit of steam, losing a bit of form. They could get something out here, but this Atletico side is, Joe, you have to realize something. They've conceded less goals than Barcelona have done, and they haven't lost, and Barcelona has not lost a single game. It's incredible.
It's
36 goals, 9 goals against for Atletico, 62 goals for Barcelona, but 11 conceded.
Yeah, I mean, but, that's Atleti's trademark, though, isn't it, though?
And they only lost one game.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
But solid defensively, that is hallmark Cholo Simeone, isn't it? That gritty Atleti side that we're used to seeing. It's pretty normal for them. But in the end, that's the only team chasing Barca. It's the only team chasing Barca right now. And with Barca focused on Champions League as well as Copa del Rey, really trying to pull off a treble of their own this year, I think Atleti could make it a race. As I hinted to earlier, I don't think in the end that they will. But because I think Barca is just too strong, and I think there's just enough... There's enough points at the bottom of the table for Barca to steal to really just seal the deal. But Atleti's the only one within striking distance at this point.
It is. And they're definitely looking to get that Europa League spot. The Europa League title as well.
Sure, absolutely. So,
go ahead.
No, you're up.
Yeah, absolutely. In Ligue 1, we have the big derby that a lot of people are waiting for the... I think there's a name for this, right? PSG Marseille?
Yeah.
There's a name for it.
Ligue Classique.
Oh, Ligue Classique. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. For some reason, I was thinking Lyon, but anyway, it's Ligue Classique between PSG and Marseille Sunday at 3 p.m. I mean, this game is really, I think PSG really have to bounce back from their Champions League loss the other day, but, I think it's just, a matter of time before PSG really wrap this up, wrap the league up.
Yeah,
quickly.
Absolutely. They're 13 points ahead of Monaco, 14 points ahead of Marseille. Even if Marseille sneak a win here, I don't think it does enough to really damage the title hopes for PSG in Ligue 1. But at the same time, it's a rivalry. It's a derby, and I think from that standpoint, you have to worry about, PSG. You have to worry about a physical game happening. You want to keep your team healthy. It wouldn't shock me if we saw some substitutes in this one, Rob, on the PSG side, just to keep everybody fit and healthy for the Champions League second leg against Real Madrid.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
heading into the Premier League, we have Manchester United against Chelsea Sunday at 9 a.m. and also Arsenal against City as well. I mean, two games that I think, are really big in its perspective. I mean, you want to see... A race, I guess, for top four. You know, given United's form, I guess, recently, you know, they want to see if they can, you know, top Chelsea. You know, they have a 3-point gap between second and fourth. And then you look at Arsenal, a team that is only that's in sixth place, having their own troubles. You know, if they can get something out of Manchester City, you know, I think they're back into that race to a Champions League spot. I mean, you know, I think they're always going to be focused on the Champions League. But these are two games that I think is really going to tie up this top five even more, even though I think the season is basically over. Yeah. Nevertheless,
two points on the two matches. One, the United Chelsea matchup. Chelsea needs this result more than United. Right now, Spurs are 1 point back, nipping at their heels. You know, there's all the turmoil, people talking about Conte out and that sort of thing. They need a result here. More, I think, that more so than Manchester United do. The sub game of the week for the EPL, which is not even really a sub game, the Arsenal City matchup. Arsenal need that match badly. Second spot. They need a result there. They need 3 points. They've got to get to within striking distance of Spurs, and they're not going to do it by dropping, you know, massive results to City. So there's something in it for them there that the Emirates they're going to have to kind of work hard on Sunday. I'm sorry, actually that matchup is March 1st, I believe. So that's going to be one that they're going to have to really focus on to pick up points.
Yeah, absolutely. Heading into Serie A, we have AS Roma against Milan Sunday at 2:45 p.m. Also, Juve at Atalanta. I mean, you know, I think the great form that a team like AC Milan is having could really, as you said, Joe, over the weekend, you know, they could really jump back into this race for Europe. I mean, you know, Roma is losing a bit of steam, you know, Inter is losing a bit of steam, and with Juventus, you know, it's basically a race between those two. I mean, there's a 15-point gap between second and third. You know, this is basically a race between either Napoli, Juventus, for that Scudetto, and I mean, one more slipless in this game against Atalanta, which, you know, I'm pretty sure a team inspired by Papu Gomez, who are really good as a team overall. You know, if they get something at the J Stadium, you know, this is going to be really, really bad for Allegri's men, don't you think?
Yeah, on the Juve Atalanta matchup, it's a nightmare for Juve to drop points, especially. And I'm just going to look through the schedule right now because I think Napoli have something of a layup. Yeah, they have Cagliari, who is is currently 14th in the league. So, you know, you'd expect them to win, even though on the weekend, Napoli only managed a 1-0 victory over Spal. So you would have expected them to be much more dominant against Spal, but didn't need to be. The one goal was plenty. But again, from a Juve standpoint, they need these points. They need all 3 points all day long. Atalanta also trying to sneak their way. They're 3 points out of that European spot. So they're looking at this as a must win. You know, you're going to get the A game out of Atalanta in this one. Back to match of the week, though, like you'd said, Milan right now is only outside of Europe by goal differential. That's it. So, you know, they could, I think, if they would have scored one more goal over Samp on the weekend, they actually would have leapfrogged Samp completely. So they're on the same amount of points, same wins, same draws. And Inter is only 7 points up. These are spots that are, they're valuable spots, and with the resurgence of AC Milan, you've got to think that Roma's in for a hell of a game at the Stadio Olimpico on Sunday.
Absolutely. And the last league that we'll cover is the Bundesliga. I mean, obviously the big match happening there is Bayer Leverkusen against Schalke. You know, two teams that are really fighting it out for European spots. I mean, they're separated by just 1 point, and I feel that this could really go decisive because you have other teams like Eintracht Frankfurt and Leipzig and Dortmund. You know, Joe, this is incredible. I mean, from second to really sixth, it's a 3-point gap, and that's out of European spots and into European spots. So this is just an incredible race for an already Bayern side that I think is going to wrap up the league quicker than ever with a 19-point gap. I mean, this is just a big race for the European spots.
Yeah, you know, you look at it, there's 9 points separate second from 10th. So the great thing about this for Rob, for you and I, is that when we have to come up with a match of the week for the Bundesliga, there's always going to be one. because these teams are so tight that there's always going to be a match where you're going to have two fairly evenly matched teams that are going to be fighting it out closely, fighting for European positions somehow. You're just going to get that type of match, and this is no different. Leverkusen, Schalke, I mean, just looking back at the teams, you know, Schalke's on a pretty decent run of form, winning three of their last five. Leverkusen, you're right, three of the last five. Schalke's a little bit of a dip. They've only won two, and they've lost two of their last three to Werder Bremen and obviously Bayern a couple weeks ago. So, but again, even though Schalke's in sixth, they are, 5 points ahead of Hannover, and in that European position, they've got Leipzig within striking distance. They've got Leverkusen 1 point ahead of them, and Leverkusen's in a European spot. So this is a huge for both sides on Sunday that could affect, jockeying for position for Champions League spots next year.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so those are our matches of the week. Just real quick, what I'm going to, I want to mention that the CONCACAF Champions League, as we talked about earlier, starting up this week as well, we're going to see Saprissa, Club America, Tauro FC Dallas, Colorado Rapids versus Toronto FC, Herediano versus Tigres, Montagua versus Tijuana, Club Olimpia versus the Red Bull, Santa Tecla versus Seattle Sounders, and Chibao versus Chivas Guadalajara. So those are your round of 16 matchups coming up this week in the CONCACAF Champions League. And they'll range anywhere from the 20th to the 22nd of this week. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, definitely going to catch some night football, Rob. I'm pretty excited about that. And I believe in the United States they're all on Univision.
Absolutely, you can't forget the Copa Libertadores as well. We're about to have the last few teams make up the group stages.
Oh, there you go. So, we've got Libertadores this week. We've got CONCACAF Champions League this week. We've got European Champions League. We've got Europa League. So this would be the week to stay home, right, Rob?
Basically.
Yeah, this is it. So
basically.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the trivia question, Rob. Let me repeat it for you.
Yep.
So, obviously, 56 years of the CONCACAF Champions League, there are three teams that have played two or more finals and have gone undefeated. Can you name the three teams that have never lost a final having played two or more?
Well, the first one that I'm trying to remember would be the one that we talked about before the show started. The show, is it America?
Club America is 7-0 in this competition in the finals.
Wow.
So that is correct.
Wow. That's incredible. Oh, God. I remember seeing, the history of the winners one time, but I'm not sure they haven't lost. Is it DC United?
No, DC United is one win only.
Oh, wow.
And that was a team that was considered one of the, I want to say it was 96. I have the stats up here real quick. Give me 1 second. I want to say it was 96 or 98. 98. DC United beat Toluca 1-0. And that is, with the performance from Toronto FC this year, that DC United team is considered the greatest MLS team of all time. So they've only got one win.
Oh, man, of course. I remember they run the format. It's Monterrey.
Monterrey. Three wins, no losses. And I'm just going to go back here. Last win for Monterrey was in the 2012-2013 season where they beat Santos Laguna. One more team.
And that's where I'm stuck.
And this will be out of sight, out of mind, so you probably will, even if I gave it to you, you probably wouldn't remember that they were the champions. But they are the two-time defending CONCACAF champions right now.
Pachuca.
5 wins in this competition in the finals.
Wow.
And most recently, the last two, and also 2009-2010, beating Cruz Azul. So those are your winners. America, 7 wins, no losses. Pachuca, 5 wins, no losses. Monterrey, 3 wins, no losses. Just to give you an idea on the American teams and how they have fared in this competition, LA Galaxy 1-1, 2 appearances. DC United 1-0, with that title coming in 1998. And Real Salt Lake, who is 0-1, losing the 2011 final. Montreal Impact for MLS, losing the 2015 final to Club America that we had talked about earlier as well. Those are your performances of your MLS teams in this competition. Hopefully this year, Rob, a little better. I think personally, I'm pinning a lot of hopes on Toronto FC. I really do think they can do it. I think that they're a special team, and it really comes down to how important the competition is to those MLS sides.
Absolutely.
You know, so Rob, final thought. All right, I'm going to remember to do it this week. And I guess I go first since I'm the trivia asker. And for me, I guess my final thought is kind of reflecting on what Neil said about the head coach of the U.S. Men's National Team. We do have one more year. I know Carlos Cordero is the president, and he's got so many things on his plate that need to be fixed. You hope that he surrounds himself with some big names and some good names and some change names. Personally, I would like to see, you know, maybe an Eric Winalda or Kyle Martino get called into a position of some significance with the United States Soccer Federation, where they can finally bring some of that change that is necessary. I think it would be smart or wise of him to do something like that. I think, you know, hopefully he doesn't plow the corporate line, although he is a Goldman Sachs banker by trade, and you hope that he kind of shies that away a little bit and moves on and does the right thing. I think the wisest thing would be to wait to hire a head coach until after the World Cup. I think there's going to be a great crop. I do like what Neil said about Juan Carlos Osorio. You wonder about his ability to bring them into that direction. Maybe the Ancelotti option is a better option, but again, it's going to be a coach. It's got to be a coach that not only will bring that change that we need to kind of round out our style of play as a country and our identity, but at the same time, it's got to be a coach that wants to be here. I think we need all of those pieces, and I don't think it is a absolute priority to have it done before the World Cup, but I think it is definitely a priority to do before September and before we start moving into the next cycle. So, Rob, your mark for 1 minute, sir.
Absolutely. I think one thing that I think stood out to me, and Joe, of course, I think I sent you this morning, was the Players Tribune article on Lorenzo Zinia. He wrote a really wonderful autobio, like a short autobio, about, you know, his career, his beginnings at Napoli. You know, they said that his coach wasn't able to get playing time because he was too small. I think he was now he's a 5'4 player, and that really makes sense. But the one thing that stood out to me is the way that, you know, he was a player that idolized the original Ronaldo, Fenomeno. But yet, you know, he coming from Napoli and coming from a family of Napoli supporters, you know, that they see, you know, Diego Maradona as God, you know, Dios, el Dios, D10S, as something like that. It's just incredible about how big an impact a player can have to an entire city and its culture, even though he's only there for, I believe, 6 years or 5 years, something like that. You know, it's just incredible that his name will always be remembered by the people of Naples. And Joe, I guess I can connect this back to you. I mean, you know, I think you've seen how big a connection Maradona has to the city of Napoli.
It exists to this day. You know, and we're talking somebody that was there 30 years ago, and it still exists to this day. He's Napoli's treasure, is what it comes down to, and I think they treat him that way. I also got a kick out of the story about how he wanted Ronaldo's boots, how he begged his father daily, please, Daddy, I want these soccer shoes. I want these soccer shoes. And he finally got his Ronaldo boots. I thought that was a pretty cool part of the story to me. You can picture a little tiny Italian kid who kind of forced his way on because he wouldn't shut up at his brother's practice. And going from there to where he is now, one of the better strikers in Italy, and somebody that Gianpiero Ventura probably wishes he played against Sweden, but we're not going to reopen that wound.
So, no, why not?
So, all right, man. With everything on the list finally covered tonight, and we really didn't have any glitches with the audio. I'm kind of happy about that. Let's close it out, man.
Sounds good.
Let's do it. Let's close it out. So, for episode 192 of Low Limit Football, Rob, we got to do something big for 200. We'll have to figure that one out.
We do.
Yeah, so, but this is 192. Special thanks again to Neil Blackman from theyanksarecoming.com for joining us tonight. We had a great, great time with him. Next week, we're going to recap the second leg of the Champions League. We're going to look at the final 16 in the Europa League, of course. We're going to see how the first legs went in CONCACAF Champions League. We will recap Copa Libertadores. And I'm sure we're also going to preview MLS as they start up in the next couple of weeks. So, for episode 192 of Low Limit Football, I'm Joe Uccello. Thanks for listening, and good night.